Okay. We're going to do a gear change for the next few moments. Think about implementing lasting change. Worth thinking about this, I think, on a number of levels, all of life is changing, my sense. All of ministry is changed. We're trying to bring ourselves and others under the Lordship of Christ, and we are resistant to that because of our sinful natures. So, obviously, we're talking about trying to produce a kind of different way of doing things. So I think the principles out there have applications for us as individuals, but we are predominantly thinking about, okay, how do we affect change, culture change in a congregation? How do we change the way we do things in a congregation? That's fundamentally what we're thinking about. However, I do think it has got interactions for ourselves, our interactions with individuals, perhaps a group, church, we're thinking those things through. We're at the third stage so far. We've been building on the work of Craig Hamilton, his book, Wisdom in Leadership. So if you want to read ahead, you can there, that's fine. I guess so far we've thought about, or rather we've drawn attention to, a sense of urgency. We need to do something here. To use John Cotter's language, our iceberg is melting. We can't stay here, it's melting. It won't be here. We can be here for a bit, but at some point this won't be here any longer. We've got to do something, we've got to move. So we've pointed out to people that we have to do something, or look, we can't leave this unaddressed any longer. This is, come on, seriously. I guess it's the ministry equivalent of showing pictures of rising sea levels, footage of glaciers breaking up and falling in the Arctic, trying to get a change-resistant country and change-resistant population to address the issues that might have led to that. So this, the first stage, is the kind of the initial weight that needs to be applied to get the case for change up and running. So think of it as a kind of, you know, the force that is applied, you know, there's this huge, immovable, large boulder. How do I shift it? Well, to shift it, there's got to be a whole shed load of weight that gets applied to it. That is the kind of the case for change, the sense of urgency. We have to do something about this. That's the first stage. Secondly, we've gathered like-minded allies from all levels and all areas of church life. So seniority, you know, up and down the food chain, but across church life. There are people who think the same that we do. It's trying to win hearts and minds. It's getting them, getting a critical number so that we can begin to get this thing moving. That creates some momentum. In other words, if it's just me pushing, I'm not going to shift the boulder. But if there's a whole load of us pushing the boulder, we can begin to get some movement into the system. What we need to do now is to build on those. And we're thinking about developing a specific vision for change. At which point we're making, hang on a second. What have we been talking about so far, if we haven't been talking about that? I guess the first step is raising the problem and convincing people that it exists. The second step is gathering people who share that view that the situation needs addressing. But now, this step, we identify and clarify what we're going to do and how that's going to be communicated. This is not stage four. Stage four is the plan, which is the how, the detail, the kind of the work it through thing. This is the kind of what. So we said, there's a problem, do you agree? Yes, I agree. Okay, what are we gonna do? Well, we're gonna change it. We're gonna do something. This, rather than staying put and ending up here, what we're gonna do is this and we're gonna end up there. Now, at that point, there's nothing at all about how you're gonna do it. That comes next. So I would imagine that if you've identified there's a problem that needs addressing, I guess you've also identified solutions, given the kind of guys that you are. You think, hey, there's a problem here, I'll fix it. And so it's there. But you have to restrain yourself at this point. So don't race ahead. Don't solve the problem that you've identified. Because part of the problem for that, of course, is that people will then address the solution, not the problem. And you want a whole load of people addressing the problem, because you'll probably end up with a better solution. So do the best you can, never to be drawn on the question, so what do you think we should do? Just don't go there, because the trouble is people will write that off, and what they're doing in writing that off is also the need for change. So just say, look, we've identified a problem, there's a number of us that agreed. In one sense, the future part, what do you think? Don't ask me, what do you think? Let me read my notes, sorry. Yes, never be drawn to answer this, so what should we do question. No matter how you phrase it, it's going to be hard for people to think that isn't your proposal, but it can't be. Partly because you haven't stopped thinking about it yet. You haven't stopped thinking about it yet. You've not really started thinking about it yet. That's what this stage and the next stage is all about. If you are forced to give your opinion, make sure that it is totally absent of anything that might resemble conviction. You know, completely kind of, I don't know, maybe, it just could be, I'm not sure, I wonder whether, I don't really know. Now, if you've been active in raising awareness of the problem and gathering a coalition of allies, you are at that stage likely to have a whole load of information. That's really helpful. In other words, if you've talked to people about the problem, is you gather people, they will, I wonder whether, I think we should, have you thought about, get that all down, gather it. It's all information, all useful. I guess then what we have to do is work out, okay, what is the preferred future towards which we'd like to head? That is going to be shaped by the information that you've had, but it's going to be, look, if we carry on, this is where we'll end up, but if we do this, this is where we'll end up. This is about developing a vision for change. It's about the preferred future. And creating that plan for change, or rather that vision for change, I should say, not plan, that's the next one, is a three-stage process. And I've put it on the sheet there, hopefully it makes sense. It's essentially widen the choice, find the feeling, craft the pitch. Some of this will be familiar. I think it's quite good to have it spelled out. Okay, widen the choice. Having persuaded people that there's an issue that needs addressing, and having recruited people to the cause, this thing can't be left unaddressed any longer. We don't want to waste the opportunity to put a credible plan before that. So how do we do that? Well, decisions. We need to make some decisions. There are typically three ways of making decisions. There is proposal A, that's one way. There is proposal A and proposal B, it's another way. And there's proposal A, B, and C, to put it very simply. Let me explain what I mean by that. Proposal A is, we could do this. Shall we do it or shan't we do it? That is a kind of, it's described as a whether or not decision. Apparently it's how teenagers make decisions, which should alert us to its limitations as a reliable methodology. It's not really a choice between two decisions. It's a choice between one decision. Shall we do it, shan't we? You know, and so, you know, teenagers will typically think, should I get a burger from Five Guys or not? It's not, there's a whole range here, which one should I do? Apparently, in a few moments, I'll touch on some of the research that's gone into this, quite interesting. So that's a kind of whether or not, and we can do that. Shall we do it? Shan't we do it? Shall we get new hymn books? Shan't we get new hymn books? Rather than addressing the problem, which is back here, people who agree with you, right, what should we do? Let's think about some options. We could do this, we could do this, we could do this, rather than shall we get a new hymn book, shan't we? Proposal A and proposal B, it is a genuine choice between two options. Here are two credible ways of addressing the problem we've identified. One is called proposal A, the other one is called proposal B. We could do either of those. Then the third way of making decisions is essentially there's a whole heap of evidence to suggest that if we avoid making a binary decision with at least a third option, it is so much better. I think I've read something somewhere that suggests if you can do a fourth option, it's even better. But that third option has to be kind of real and genuine. We could do it. So it's interesting, I'm talking to a church last week, and they have a number of options ahead of them, of things they could do, purchasing buildings, planting congregations, moving in and taking over congregations. And they are kind of, I don't know. So now I've put together a matrix which explains, you know, looks at a number of those plans. I think I got up to F, plan A to F. And you look at those and you think, okay, what are the benefits? What are the costs? You're just doing that all the way through. And presumably, I don't think that I don't know whether they'll do any of those, but they can look at it and go, okay, we get that. I think that one's the best decision, isn't it? Or a combination of that and that. But it's enriched by the fact they've had to engage with a whole number of things. Let me give you some of the stats. They're very, very interesting. So statements of resolve or whether or not decisions, I resolve to go to Five Guys or shall we go to Five Guys, yes or no. Apparently 65% of decisions that teenagers make are in that category. It's been really interesting just thinking about that and the way I parent one of our kids, because he's thinking, do I, don't I? Should I treat my mum with respect or shouldn't I? I reckon if I gave him three options about how he could treat his mother, that he actually could make better decisions. Because what he can't is, I shall, I shan't I? It's very just interesting. Apparently, only 30% of teenagers' decisions have more than one option. Now, building on that, one guy decided to have a look at businesses, nonprofits, and government institutions to work out how do they make decisions. And it turns out that most of those make decisions like teenagers. So 29% of decisions in this study, 29% were made between more than one option. 71% fall into the teenagers category. Shall we, shan't we? Whether or not, extraordinary. And I'm just trying to reflect on that. You know, for example, the commission, the stuff that we, the, where we're making decisions, just thinking, okay, how many of them? I thought I was pretty encouraged by that. But it's just interesting. Lots of organizations make whether or not decisions. Apparently, of those whether or not decisions, 52% of them fail over the long term. So if you make a shall we, shan't we decision, at least half of the time, that would be a bad decision. Apparently, of those whether or not decisions, sorry, if you make decisions in the kind of multiple options, 32% of them end up in failure, which I have to say, I find still quite a depressing number, but it's better than 52, isn't it? It's better than 52. So at least, two thirds of the time you're right, one third of the time you're not. So as the writer says, by adding just one genuine alternative, you dramatically increase the likelihood of making a good decision, and one about twice as likely to make a successful decision. The point is, on this, widen the choice. What you're saying is, what could we do? And the answer to that is not, we could do this. It's not, we could do this or we could do this. It's we could do this, we could do this, or we could do this. So in other words, widen the choice. You're much likelier to make a better decision going forward if you've got multiple things that you're prepared to look at. And often, actually, the fourth, which is a combination of perhaps some of the best of the three, will be even better. That's the first thing. Second thing, find the feeling. So widen the choice, find the feeling. Now, what we're doing at this stage is we're trying to address the issue of motivation. I will go off on a slight tangent at one point to talk about how that is different to manipulation. But motivation is about giving people a reason to embrace the change that they may not have realised that they need or they may not have wanted. Now, in trying to find a feeling, we're recognising that feelings are not facts alone. Feelings are not facts alone and change people. So people change, not because they know they should, but because they feel they want to. So it's not for lack of facts that people don't change. So if someone won't change, you won't change their mind by putting facts at them. It's the kind of lack of feeling that you've got to address. They've got to feel that they want to change. Take smoking, for an example. Everyone knows what smoking does to you. The warnings, all of that kind of stuff. The facts are well known, they are terrifying, and they are incontestable. And I don't think any of those statements could be challenged. And yet, despite the facts being well known, and being terrifying, and being incontestable, guess what? People smoke, they still smoke. Facts are not enough to bring about change. And my wife sees people all the time as a GP. often with the smoking issue, sometimes with the eating issue as well. And she knows that facts won't. She's got to kind of, got to find the feeling. People need a reason beyond the facts to change. It's something that gets under their skin and addresses their own inertia. In smoking, it might, for example, be the fear of losing control and becoming addicted to something that will take over their lives. And that's enough for people to be scared and to generate the feeling, I've got to change. Now, look, you know, the facts and feelings can kind of overlap a bit, but I think in trying to draw them apart, hopefully that's making sense. Whatever it is, we need to figure out what the feeling is that people need to find so that they'll change. You know, so what is it? How is this person wired? How are these people wired so that they're prepared to consider an alternative future? Because we've shown them where we go if we stay put. What about if... So is it, for example, being a part of something that matters? So I was thinking, I was in Dundonald on Sunday evening and I was allowed to talk about church planting. And you're thinking, terrific congregation. It's just, why would you ever want to move from there? It looks fantastic. Everything I saw was fantastic. You know, good leaders, spread of ages, you know, lots of health going on there. I'm trying to think, okay, how do I get them to church plant? That's not my job, but you know, but it, for example, here are some of the things they might be. Is it being part of something that matters? Are they the type of person who want to be a certain type of person? You know, they don't want to be conservative. They want to be risky. Is wanting to please God and hear him say, well done, good and faithful servant, is that something that matters? Is it the joy of seeing lives radically transformed? Is it a feeling that they've used their life well, they didn't waste it? Is it the thrill of being a pioneer? How are they wired? How is this congregation wired? What am I going to go after? What are the things that they think really matter? Because that's potentially going to be a way in. I guess the key question is, what is the feeling that will drive people to embrace and implement the change? Now, at this point, I think we've got to say something about manipulation and motivation. Because obviously motivation is good, giving people a reason why they should do something. Manipulation is bad, it's coercive. But we are trying to appeal to people's emotions, not just their intellect. So manipulation, if I've understood it correctly, is feeling without reason. When I became Christian shortly afterwards, there was a whole lot of discussion about what are we doing in our music. And the big criticism of some form of music was that it was just purely manipulative. In other words, it was, you know, producing the liver shiver with amazing music, moving people. And what was moving them wasn't the truth of what was being sung or the truth of what was being said. It was simply an emotional response. And there's a great anxiety. This is manipulative. It's about manufacturing feelings. That's manipulation. Motivation is thinking and feeling. It is giving people a reason, a fact, to do something. So in one sense, it's giving people the facts in such a way that it moves their feelings. It's helping them to feel the reason for change. So I was just scribbling down, trying to work this out. Thinking, just thinking, without feeling, is inadequate to move things. That's the kind of the guy who knows everything about smoking but still smokes. Feeling without thinking is inappropriate. It's kind of, you're just, you know, you're moving someone, but without them really being engaged on the reason for the change. Thinking with feeling is inspiration. That's kind of my methodology. And the difference between the two is evidence. It's the reason. Put it that way. It's not just the facts, but it's the facts applied to a heart. So in the smoking example, the footage of a dad playing football with his young son, but he's unable to run after him. He's bent double, he's coughing his lungs up, and he's struggling to breathe. That works for some. So for the dads out there who are thinking, hang on a second, just had a baby. I don't want to be the dad who can't play football with his nine-year-old son. Because, you know, I've either got lung cancer or I can't breathe or whatever. That's addressing the fear that the guy thinks, I'm just going to grow up to be a useless dad. In one sense, that's finding the feeling. So in other words, it's the truth applied to his situation to try and get under the skin and address the motive. Craig Hamilton puts it this way: you present the evidence, and that's important because your goal isn't to manipulate, and the evidence causes people to feel something. What they feel might be shock at the depth of the problem or excitement at the possibility of a healthier process. But either way, the evidence hits people at an emotional level. If you appeal only to logic, you'll have direction, but no motivation. We can come back to that. I find that quite helpful just to think through. Thirdly, finally, craft a pitch. Crafting a pitch is about communicating the compelling case and solution for change. In two sentences, what we want to be able to do is answer the question, what needs to be done to turn this place around? So we're talking there about a 30-second answer. So it's the elevator pitch, isn't it? You know, you get in the lift, the doors close, you go traveling up to, you know, the third floor or whatever, and the person turns to you and says, what do you think should be done? And so it's that kind of, right, I haven't got much time, this has got to be punchy. As depressing as it is for those of us who spend every waking moment thinking, talking and praying about what we're doing and how we're doing it, the truth is most people in our congregations don't care. And we need to be able to make them care as quickly as possible. Or rather, people care, but they sometimes care about the wrong things and the things they really need to care about and not the things. And we need to sort of break through the noise and get into their heads very quickly. We need to be able to break through and make them see there's a problem here. We need to do something about it. And this would be a preferred future. Now, that takes more effort than you might imagine. And normally it's at the end of a long process of you thinking carefully with others about what is the problem? Why is the problem? What can we do about it? How are we going to summarize that? Whatever you have, those two sentences are going to take several edits and a fair amount of crafting. And you want to get it to the place where it simply just rolls off the tongue. So, for example, with British Church Peckham, we got to the point where I was saying something like, we think too many churches are divided down cultural lines. We want to plant a church of such diversity that it can only be explained by the gospel. That was it. Actually, the second bit was what tended to be what I go. We're trying to plant a church of such diversity that it can only be explained by the gospel. And just leave that. And actually, in one sense, that invites people to say, sorry, hang on a second, just go through that again. Or what makes you say that? Or what is the situation? So the problem we're wanting to solve is that we think too many churches are divided on cultural lines. We want to plant a church of such diversity that can only be explained by the gospel. That's the elevator pitch type thing. So in other words, why are you putting a new church plant into Peckham? There are loads of churches there already. Why are you doing it? Why? Well, for us, the preferred future is a church which is deliberately diverse from day one, with mixed leadership and mixed congregation and so on. So there was that kind of, okay, I now get why you're doing what you're doing, or I now get why you're trying to do this thing that you're trying to do, or I now get why you are trying to pitch to me either to be involved or to be supported in some way. I get it. That's what we're after. So craft the pitch. Two top tips to do that. Number one, make it visual. So help people see the change. The thing about vision is it's visual, not verbal, or rather it's word pictures. So for example, I would imagine, and I don't know, but I think I probably saw some pictures like this. The proposal down in Rains Park to knock down the factory, which was a functioning building and had been a functioning building for some time. It worked, it had flexible space. It wasn't ideal, but it worked. That proposal to knock down the factory and build something new in its place was made possible because of the artist's drawings that put in front of people a visual representation of what that change would look like. And so it allowed people to see a preferred future. You could have two options. You could have a generally deteriorating factory, or you could have this big new shiny thing. Ooh, yes, let's do that. How are we going to do it? Don't know, we're not at that stage yet. But that's which of those two would you prefer? Ooh, it's obvious, no brainer, I'll go for that one. Okay. Secondly, make it narrative, which is not, you know, it's sort of supplementary to the first. Help people not just see the change, but experience the change. For example, when you're not talking about something that is physical, but nonetheless real, describe it. So for example, you might be in a congregation that has no culture of training. And you're trying to convince the congregation, or you're trying to convince a leadership team that you want to start this ministry training program. And no one has any idea what that looks like. They've seen the sheets and they've seen the costs, but you know, and once it's those are the facts and it's not shifting anyone, this huge great boulder is staying put, it's got complete inertia, you're bombarding it with figures and it's just nothing is happening. But if you've got someone who comes in, who's able to talk about, okay, this is where I was, this is the stage of life that I was at, this is what I did in moving away from my job, and this is what I did. I got involved in this, this, and this in the church family. I went to elders meetings. I was involved in the youth ministry, and you know, they got me preaching. I prepared sort of Bible study notes every now and again, and I went to theological college, and I knew which essays to write and which essays to study and what not to waste my time on, and actually changed it. And I came out, and this is what I've done. There's a story there. It helps people sort of be immersed into a new reality. So they're thinking, why would we ever do this? Why would we ever do this? Meet this guy, hear about his story into ministry and the advantages that he derived as a result of being a ministry trainee. And it's a game changer. Like, you know, you can think of lots of situations like that, perhaps, you know, in terms of church planting. So why would I do a church planting sort of internship? Well, because I got to see behind the scenes. I knew what I was being prepared for. I knew what I needed to look out for, and so on and so forth. So make it narrative, people. It's why when we have a patron's evening for commission, we'll often have wealthy businessmen and wealthy businesswomen sit around a table. And in one sense, yeah, they want to see the spreadsheets of the finance and the proposals for planting, and I can talk about the different ways we plant. But honestly, the game changer is when someone stands up and says, look, we've been working in such and such a place, and I want to tell you about Carlos. Carlos is a taxi driver. We met him because he's the guy I've used all the time to take me out to the airport, got to know him, invited him to a men's curry night. We started reading the Bible together. He's become a Christian and he's invited his family to come to church. This is Carlos. This is Carlos and his wife and his two girls. Now, Carlos is completely fictitious, so I'm not saying make it up, but in other words, every church plant has a story like that. And it's the fuel on the fire. So for us, I'll talk about the British-Turkish lady, single mum, with her 3.5-year-old son. You know, for me, she was the reason that to keep going. Nowhere, faith in Christ, game changer, absolute game changer. So why should we plant a church in Peckham? Well, because if we hadn't, she may not have heard the gospel, and her eternity has been changed, and we pray so as that of her son and her future. It's that kind of help people see the narrative, help people experience the change, as you describe it in terms of narrative form. Okay. Right, just worth saying a little aside at this point. I for all our planters and you guys who are pre-planting, we'll get to do this at some point. I reckon you need three pitches. You need the 30-second, the 3-minute, and the 30-minute. And they're useful for different things. The 30-second pitch is the, you know, oh, this is an unexpected. I suddenly find myself in front of a wealthy Christian businessman who asks me why I'm doing what I'm doing. What are you going to say? 30 seconds. Or here's the potential person who might join our plant. What do I say? 30 seconds. You need that pitch. The 3-minute is when you get interviewed in the London Gospel Partnership meeting, or the FIC London gathering, or perhaps at the prayer meeting. of another local church. It's the 3-minute version. It's the 30-second expanded, but it's 3 minutes. The other version you need is 30 minutes, perhaps it's not 30 minutes, that's possibly too long. It's the PowerPoint presentation that you break it down. This is where we are, this is what we're doing, this is why we're doing it, this is how we're doing it, it's that kind of thing. It's the kind of, it's a bit like a bit more Dragon's Den. It's what you'll give to us at some point, and we will sit there in judgment on everything that you've done and tell you what you're doing brilliantly and areas perhaps for improvement. It's that version, okay? Now, let me conclude. That is stage three. At this stage, just worth saying, how many weeks have we got to go before we get there? There's no plan yet. This is a vision for change. All we've done so far is say, guys, there's a problem. There is a problem, isn't there? Yes, there is. We absolutely have to do something about this. Secondly, saying who's on board? It's the Hearts and Minds campaign. Okay, I've got enough now to actually generate some change. Thirdly, this is the vision for change. What's the preferred future we'd like to see? How are we going to work out what that is? The kind of the what are we going to do about this? It is different from the how we're going to do it. So in other words, it's like, oh my life, look at our congregation. We've got no one who can lead anything anywhere. We are a missionary-led church plant. This is a nightmare. This is nuts. There's a problem, isn't there? Yeah, yeah. Who agrees? All of us, yeah. Okay, right, what are we going to do? We've got to train people, haven't we? We've got to train people. Everyone agreed on that? We've actually got to equip and empower people to do that. Everyone agreed? Yeah, yeah, yeah. Right, how are we going to do it? Don't know. Let's get to that. But we are, that's what we want, isn't it? Okay. So anyway, I'm done.